Hello and welcome to the M&A Zing, the show for acquisition entrepreneurs, search funders and whole code builders across the UK and Europe. Each week we dive into the real world stories, strategies and challenges behind buying and building small businesses. And whether you're searching for your first deal or running a group of companies, this is your space to learn, share and get inspired. Regular listeners will be happy to see that we're back to our standard format, and I welcome back my erudite co-host, Gareth Hawkins. Welcome back, Gareth.
Thanks, Alfie. You flatter me with that adjective, sir. I'm not so sure our regular listeners will be all that pleased, because you and Toby have done a fantastic job of covering while I was summering. And so thank you very much for keeping the content wheels turning and smashing out some insightful episodes. We've got a full lineup of insightful interviews coming up as well, and some more buy-side breakdowns. So yeah, it's a busy season ahead. But here we are at the beginning of September. The whole kind of quarter and year beyond laid out before us. You know, I guess this episode is to talk about what that might have in store.
Yes, I feel there's a lot of sort of back to school, back to work, end of summer energy, and we want to capitalize on that and sort of reflect on what's gone and yeah, look at the year ahead, look at what's happening in M&A widely, look at the market, off market, all the things that we like to delve into. I think this is the best time to do that. We've got a couple of months of good work ahead of us before we have another break for Christmas.
Yeah, although it hasn't felt this year like the world ground to a summary halt. I think there's been this greater bias for action amongst the investor and acquirer community during August, which you know, has felt like, despite the good weather, people have still wanted to, you know, be at their desks or at least on the end of their mobiles, doing deals and backing projects, which is really encouraging. I think it's a sign of returning confidence more than anything. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was going to say it's either that or the fact that we had a nice spring, so nobody was desperate for a bit of August sun.
Maybe we all got too much sunshine. But cool. So it's been an interesting few months of M&A activity within the M&A space as well, which is quite ironic and interesting, because we heard last month in early August that the US platforms are starting to consolidate in the M&A search tools and M&A deal suite tools. So we see Datasite, who own Grata, acquiring SourceScrub. So there's some consolidation happening there, which is super interesting. And then on the lender side, we have seen the announcement that Shawbrook Bank are buying ThinCats, or are merging, acquiring ThinCats. So yes, that may or may not be a massive change. A couple of alt lenders coming together, but certainly these are two buoyant players in the space that have, you know, written a lot of checks to get a lot of deals done over the last few years. So it'd be interesting to see how the landscape looks post that integration.
And do you think the Shawbrooks and ThinCats integration is a result of the high street lenders coming back?
Yes, I think it's exactly a consequence of that. There were some wilderness years post COVID with the interest rates going up that sort of high street banks didn't really want to touch SMB lending, particularly SMB M&A, to the greater extent that they did previously. And I think that gap was more than adequately filled by the alternative lenders, who obviously have different economics and different margins that they need to make, and therefore different interest rates. And I think the return of these high street banks to the fray with their rates is going to create some more competition. And that will lead to, I guess, consolidation amongst the alternative lenders. But that's probably good for scale. It's probably good for professionalization of certain products that maybe previously were emerging products. So, yeah, I think it's all part of the fun of the fair, right? But no doubt they'll be stronger than the sum of the parts.
We'd like to think so. I think that's exciting. And it's been a really busy time in UK S&B M&A. So I shared some news on our LinkedIn page about a month ago that said that we'd seen increased activity in M&A in the UK. And I surmised that it was probably from, you know, the larger end of the market. But actually, Experian's H1 2025 review just came out, said that SMBs accounted for 88% of disclosed value transactions in the UK. So sort of fewer blockbuster deals and a lot more mid-market movement, which is exactly the world our audience operate in.
Well, that's where the gold is. I think that's where the value creation comes from. I think, you know, the take privates, you know, there's fewer of those opportunities. You know, there was a big spate of private equity taking public companies that were sort of struggling at the lower end of the market, taking them private and then relisting them in a different geography, arbitraging the geography, for example. And I think, you know, there's only so many of those that you can do. There's only so many candidates at any given time. But also in terms of large businesses that are available for sale, large private businesses that are available for acquisition, you know, in the hundreds of millions non-listed sense, that's tricky. It's a small playing field now, and there's lots of private equity funds that need to, that have dry powder that they need to do deals. So it's for a long time now, you know, a good few years, it's been a case that deal activity has been coming down the value chain in terms of company sizes. And the sort of lower mid-market is being increasingly buoyant. So it doesn't really surprise me that there's so many deals going on. I think you've got to look at also the nature of those deals. So are they private equity or are they trade acquisitions? You know, in periods of slower organic growth, companies are going to look to buy competitors or make adjacent or vertical acquisitions to improve their position and put their cash to use. That's only good practice. So I think that plus, obviously, as we know, the increasing number of acquisition entrepreneurs in the space and employee ownership trusts. There are, you know, now multiple avenues for sellers to exit. It's still woefully low in terms of number of deals that are getting done. It's good to see a greater emphasis on the lower middle market. I still don't think it comes down necessarily far enough to well serve those businesses that are circa a million in EBITDA, or 1 to 2 million EBITDA. I think those guys still get left behind to an extent. So there's a job to do there on that broad base of the pyramid. But great to see the smaller businesses or the lower mid market being buoyant.
Yeah, and I feel like, as you said, it will pull through. You know, it does work its way down the chain. And we said there's a lot of other positives going on at the moment. You know, there's more lending on the market. There's a lot more appetite for people to sell, and we'll get into, you know, some of the regulatory and other reasons behind that. But it does feel like we are pulling in the right direction, and it is gathering a bit of pace. We are still, you know, some ways behind our cousins in the US, but we're moving in the right direction.
Well, certainly, and I think that waterfall, that cascade that you speak of, actually creates a bit of a kind of incubation or an environment for a conveyor belt, if you will, of growing smaller businesses, getting them to a material size where they can be either bolted onto or acquired outright by the larger private equity or trade players. And so acquisition entrepreneurship has this great role to play in, you know, taking those smaller businesses that are just below that viable threshold for acquisition to you know, a larger and material entity, and either through their own strategic sort of small business platforming and roll-ups, or just by, you know, rejuvenating and you know, speedily growing the businesses that they buy and just tipping them over that, you know, million or 1.5 million threshold in EBITDA value. So I think self-funded search is going to benefit as a consequence of this trend.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting and really exciting times.
Sure is. Yeah. But what is hugely exciting is just, you know, there was a period 2 years ago where you would speak to a new searcher, you know, once every month, maybe, that someone would be popping up and saying, I'm starting a search. Now, you know, they're daily. It's fabulous to see the real momentum through which entrepreneurs have been switching to this space and seeing the value of buying rather than building from zero. That definitely correlates with the Move Music shift from VC to private equity. And, you know, it's really nice to see the business schools pushing this in greater number now.
Absolutely. I was about to say that leads us sort of nicely into our first topic for this, which is the growth of ETA education in business schools in the UK and Europe. And we've talked about this before, that you know, if we look at the US as a blueprint for the ETA movement, it kind of started in academia, right? You had the sort of Chicago Business School, and it was happening outside of that, but they sort of led the charge, and it grew across the schools, and more searches were put out into the ecosystem, and they've had their time to grow into those roles. But it's really starting to take root here. So I know lots of business schools have touched on this, but I think, you know, LBS are now offering an ETA elective, and they have a student-run ETA club.
Yeah, I would say they've been the strongest in the UK for a few years on this.
Yeah, INSEAD have also established a dedicated ETA hub. Yeah, and search funds.
In the last couple of years, they have come on leaps and bounds. I mean, if you'd attended the first ETA kind of get together at INSEAD, what, 3-4 years ago, it was a, you know, you could have filled the broom cupboard. But you went to the one earlier this year, and it was oversubscribed. It was a full lecture theatre. There was, God, hundreds of people there. So the speed at which this is gaining momentum is incredible. Did you have some others that you were listing there? Sorry if I spoke over you.
An interesting one that I just discovered, because obviously we do look beyond the shores of the UK, is Rotterdam's Erasmus Business School have just launched an ETA Society as well. And they actually have their first ETA Society conference at the end of this month
November, is it?
Yeah. Yes, at the end of November. And, you know, I've talked often about ETA and, you know, in Southern Europe, and it's very prolific in Spain, and it's started to grow in Italy. But to see it, you know, reaching its tentacles across the rest of Europe is also super encouraging.
Yeah, I think if you were to write a recipe book around the ingredients required and the sort of cooking process to make a properly functioning ecosystem for search in a geography, if you were kind of, you know, looking to drop behind enemy lines and sort of make a beachhead, there's a certain series of things that you need. And I think that played out originally in the US and then in Spain, and now in London and Northern Europe, you can see these things coalescing. And fundamentally, that all began with the kind of the kernel inside these academic institutions, but surrounded by these family offices that had the appetite to back these projects. They were probably the vanguard, really, these family offices, of being willing to embrace these alternative assets, these alternative projects, and see the benefit of the IRR that comes from them. By seeing that play out in, you know, in the northeastern states of the US and around the sort of Madrid Barcelona corridor in Spain, you can see how London now is starting to emulate that, with, you know, more and more family offices kind of circling the LBS ecosystem. Mm-hmm. But that's pushing out to like Cambridge Judge and Oxford Saïd, and I think even the Warwick Business School's looking at an ETA society, and there are a few others. It is really starting to come of age. And I don't think, you know, we held a gathering of family offices about 6 weeks ago, and you know, the this isn't foreign to them anymore. This isn't a concept that is it's not off their radar. And so that'll only increase, I think, as we start to get more example exits coming from the first vintage of UK searches. So yeah, I'm really excited about how this is playing out. And you can see the same in Benelux. So there's a number of Belgian and Dutch family offices that are now active investors in search. So your Nov Advice, Nov Adams, your Searchright Capital Partners, these are really starting to catalyze the space in their respective markets. It's the same in Germany with, you know, I think on a almost monthly basis, we're seeing another funding institution spinning up in Germany specifically to back this sort of Mittelstand buyout opportunities that search brings. So, I mean, it's how far and up and to the right can you take this, I guess? How far can you extrapolate this? Are we at the thin end of a wedge, or is it reaching a maturity?
I think there is still some way to go, because when I spoke to Robin Goldhagen from Novastone at the Serial Acquirer Symposium, and his role is investor relations, and he said that, you know, even now, a major part of his job is educating family offices on this asset class. He still speaks to, you know, very well established and well funded family offices who have not really come across this before. So I think there is still some way to go. And I think that is actually encouraging. I think if we were at the kind of deal volume that we're at now and reaching maturity, I'd be worried. I do think we are at the thin end of the wedge. I think there's still, you know, a long way to go in a good way, though. I think there's still room to grow.
The difference, I think, with Robin and Novastone and others, you know, you've got All Interests Aligned, Ralph Grass's new venture with Charles Williams and the team, and Peter Hadju. The difference between that and equity gap funding of individual deals is that what family offices and institutions particularly haven't had the opportunity to invest in is diversified portfolios through a fund structure. Sure. that hasn't been really readily available for you've had to spin up your own, if you like, portfolio and invest directly in these deals. So that's where all of these kind of family offices and regular investors in search have come from. But if you go one layer beyond those and you look for limited partners to come into a diversified fund structure, building portfolios, that is where the education emphasis, I think, is having to be spent. So, you know, Robin and David and the team there that have been raising from LPs have had to sort of lead that charge, if you will, of switching institutions onto this. And still, like the pension funds, the insurance firms, you know, the big institutions that would want access to fund structures are only now just towing the water into that. It's still, you know, with the family offices, if you will, that are the main LPs having a go at this. So I'm super excited to see how that space is going to unfold, because you could have said the same about VC 25 years ago.
Sure. And to go back to your analogy about, you know, the ingredients, do you think that the sort of proliferation of business schools talking about ETA and that kind of academic backing lends enough credence to kind of help bring those big institutions to the table that, I think, at least the pension funds, et cetera, that might have otherwise been a little bit dubious? Do you think that it kind of legitimizes the space a little bit more for those big lenders?
I think it helps because it creates a bit of an ecosystem. It creates some studies, it creates statistics, and you know, we're not short of a few graphs and a few tables now that have come out from Stanford's and the EASAs and the INSEADs and LBS, and they're all super helpful to educate us. But I think the big catalysts will be exits. You know, it took unicorns in venture for the world to beat a path to VCs and that to become a swollen movement that, you know, was ingesting capital faster than it could allocate it. And I think, you know, the same catalyst is necessary in search. You know, the 35% average IRR is hidden under a bushel, right? It's not being sung from the rooftops. And so that's where there needs to be more kind of public examples, more press, more shining examples of how a small company became a big company. You know, there was this cycle and a, you know, massive return for all the original investors that had the foresight to back the project. If we get a few more of those, not only does it cultivate the paying it forward piece, like I can see at the moment you've got a number of exited tech entrepreneurs who are backing search now because they've got capital and they want to pay it forward and they're looking for a buoyant emerging asset class. But interestingly, if we create more organic future backers, future investors from exited entrepreneurs that have bought this journey, like the Simon Websters, for example, and a few more of those, I think that will have the crowd effect of you know, encouraging more money into the space.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think also part of the, you know, to go back to comparing it to the unicorn thing with startups is because it is a bit slower and it does take a little bit longer. And we are, and you know, there are fewer sort of deals going through. I think it's maybe part of the reason why that excitement has yet to sort of bubble over, because those 35% returns are great, but it's often a little slower than, you know, building and selling a unicorn startup in 3 years or whatever they, you know, the most exciting ones have done.
Yeah, VC made a good trade out of MOIC, right? Out of multiple of invested capital, and demonstrating on paper that your valuations had increased. And the sort of primary funding rounds or dilutive funding rounds of putting new capital in to give businesses growth equity, if you like, to drive them upwards, each one of those milestones created a new valuation kind of ceiling, if you like, or raised the bar. And so it was at that point that people could feel like they were getting an increase in the book value of their investments, right? Whether that actually turned into distributions, you know, liquidity was the question. That's why I think we're facing this kind of disenfranchisement towards venture, unfortunately, during this kind of little dip in the cycle. But I think what we'll see as more distributions come from the kind of more rapid, I think, fund cycles that are going to come for these search funds, that actually that 35% will become more tangible, more known to investors. My worry, if I was to have a worry, my worry is that the amount of capital flowing into the space, particularly for the search phase of traditional search funds, is not keeping pace with the number of new searchers coming to the market. You know, we are seeing a very steep increase in the number of new searchers, new traditional search funds. And yeah, I don't know how you're seeing it play out, but I'm seeing the consequence of more choice for the search fund investors leading to some new trends, shall we say, in the way that they interact with the search funds.
Yeah, so I found some interesting stats on this, actually. So the median number of investors per search fund has actually increased to around an average of 18 backers per fund. So, you know, an Acquisition Entrepreneur
needs that to know you.
Well, they have to send a larger network of small investors to meet the needs. So you've got, you know, demand is outstripping supply, essentially.
Or, I mean, I'm seeing larger and larger search phases. So, you know, time was you'd raise 300 grand. Now it's double that. You know, I'm seeing searchers raising 500,000 and 600,000 to see themselves through 2 years, a lot of which gets spent on sourcing and due diligence and, you know, the legals and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it could be that, you know, you're raising a bigger round, a bigger search phase, of the pre-seed of buyouts, but as a consequence, your the check sizes haven't increased for that from any of the institutions. Really, people aren't going, oh yeah, I'll write you a 50 grand check then. So the unit sizes are going to have to stay the same, but you need more units. So I guess that means you need more LPs, more investors. I've heard of search funds of late taking longer to close their raises, partly because the raises are bigger, but partly because the decision times are a bit more protracted now amongst the investors. And there's more conditionality, I've noticed. So the comeback when you're at X percent, you know, that's almost becoming universal amongst the sort of established, you know, the OGs of search fund investing. Oh, come back when you're at 50%, or come back when you're at 80%. If everybody said that, no one would ever get to 50 or 80%. So it's an interesting paradox to create.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that we're moving in that direction? Because I know firsthand that that's, you know, what happened in sort of VC and startups over the last couple of years. You know, for the same general reasons, you think, just sort of less money in the space, so investors are more cautious?
I think more choice, more opportunity. But the, as I say, their fund sizes haven't necessarily kept pace with they have a portfolio construction to achieve. And let's say they want to back 15 searchers or 20 searchers, right? If 15 searchers now represents 10% of the pool of searchers rather than 50% of the pool of searchers, you know, they've got to kiss more frogs. They've got to speak to more people. They've got to screen more candidates. They've got to become more robust about how they screen those candidates, so the process just takes longer, and you know, there's a greater likelihood that more will fall by the wayside and won't reach that criticality, and so that hedging that perhaps comes as a consequence of that is almost a natural byproduct, whereby, you know, do I want to back the wrong horse and rush into backing these people, or do I want to see how they're going to get on and follow the journey of three or four of these before I make my decision as to which one of those is going to get my ticket. And we saw it play out exactly that way with VC. You know, the proliferation of startups meant that capital became, even though there's more capital, it just became more less concentrated and more the VCs had more choice, so they had to establish more robust processes to determine which ones they would invest in. It just takes a little longer.
And what do you think that means for the acquisition entrepreneurs who, you know, make up a large portion of our audience? Is it about becoming the most attractive frog?
Yeah, definitely. I do think you have to differentiate. You know, you look at a lot of the searcher websites, and there is a common theme and a common structure to them. And so telling them apart on their merits, you know, it has to be done in interview. And I know some of these search fund investors have some, you know, case studies that they ask you to do. They have personality psychometric profiling that they do. You know, they set you some challenges. These are all useful kind of filters, if you like, assessment criteria to determine whether you are, you know, likely to score highly in their measurement system. I think what it will mean for searchers is that they probably need to have some deals up their sleeve to talk confidently about. I think the hypothetical, I'll get shot down by some of the search fund investors out there that just want the searchers to focus on raising the search and then go off and do the actual sourcing. But I do think in this day and age, you know, you could be sourcing in parallel to your search raise and give yourself some optionality about, you know, which channel you then end up going. But it helps to sit in an interview, I think, and talk confidently and knowledgeably about some of the candidate companies that you are reviewing, rather than rely on hypotheticals and case studies. I think you get a more grown-up conversation, and maybe you create a bit more momentum around, look, this deal is in motion. You know, we're going to diligence it in the next 16 weeks. We'd love to have the search phase underway. And maybe that's just overambitious, but I do think it certainly helps to have some examples to point to and say, look, this is the kind of business. We're not going to be ready in time, but this is the kind of business that we would like to look at. We've done some, you know, sort of pre-diligence, if you will, to determine why we liked it and share that with you. I don't think that would hurt, because it sorts those that are intellectually attracted by search from those that are operationally geared towards search. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's, I do worry. I think part of the minefield that the search fund investors are navigating is who just wants me to pay their salary for the next 2 years versus who's genuinely got a bias for action to go out and acquire a business and get it, you know, over the line and start operating it. Because that's that latter camp are the ones that generate returns. What we don't want to see is a sort of poisoning of the well, if you will, of more searchers being backed that don't come to fruition and buy a company. Like, that would distort the numbers kind of tragically. So I think some of that hesitation is coming from, well, I don't want to back somebody that is just looking to raise the money to sit and search for 2 years. I want to back somebody that's going to get this done and deliver me a return. And that's getting, I think, more difficult to find.
Okay. How do you think that searchers can demonstrate that they do have that bias for action? I know you said that, you know, going out and doing some sourcing. Do you think that's the best thing? Do you think maybe, you know, taking part in one of the incubator programs, or, you know, what do you think they can do to sort of put their head above the parapet?
Well, I think there's a natural inclination towards experienced entrepreneurs. So you're seeing some exited tech founders, Alex Dent, for example. He got backed reasonably swiftly because he'd already, you know, delivered some great returns as an operator to the investors that backed him in his venture. Luke Grob and Tom Fry that are running LT Heritage Partners, they have credibility. Tom's at BCG. Luke was a founder at HelloFresh. Like, you would back them because sure. they've done the work. So I think those guys are finding it that they are standing out, right? Mm-hmm. But it makes it more difficult for the what were the traditional searcher candidates for trad search, which are the MBA, freshly minted MBA grads that, you know, this is the first thing they want to do with their career, or this is, you know, they haven't run a company before, but they, you know, this whole trad thing was supposed to fund them to go and do that and learn on the job, if you will. I worry that they won't get the funding as much. Go ahead.
Sorry, do you think that there is more than, and because the ecosystem is becoming more similar, that search acquisition entrepreneurs can learn from startups in that sense? So, you know, having been through the fundraising process myself, they do want to see experience. They want to see that maybe, you know, you worked at XYZ company, you've been through the process before. Is there maybe some onus on searchers to, you know, even post MBA, go and work for a recently acquired company, team up with somebody that's researching and show that they've been through the process and they know the struggles they're in, and they're not just, you know, freshly minted MBA with maybe some industry experience, and that, and they're going into it with not as much knowledge as perhaps they could?
You're already seeing the savvy MBA students and grads going that route and actually partnering up, either interning or going in as sort of operating partners or whatever with these search funds, and being able to demonstrate they've got some experience in those firms or in the searches before they then go off and create their own vehicles. And I think that's super savvy. It protracts the process, but actually it may not be a bad thing that these people come out with more experience.
Yeah, I think that there's also some scope for searchers to go and maybe even work for search funds as well. I actually spoke to a guy that worked at Moonbase while we were at the Serial Acquirer Symposium, and that was how he worked with Mr. Abdul Rahim. He went to him and asked him for funding, and he said, actually, come and work with me and learn the ropes, and then I'll fund you sort of later down the line. So sorry, that could be another route in as well. And he gets to see it from the other side of the curtain, and he's building up some really valuable experience there. As I know, people have done this again working for VCs, and then they translate that into founding startups.
Exactly. Yeah, it has ever been thus. But yeah, working for the search fund investors or working for a search fund, I think, is definitely a sort of worthwhile exercise to do to cut your teeth before you then go off and start your acquisition journey yourself. And of course, all of this is made ever more possible. You know, the being able to talk about deals that you've got under review, being able to source more actively, if you will, more efficiently. All of this is being expeditiously improved by tech. The model that was founded in the 80s, you know, it had to navigate the time and the technology that was available, which, you know, was very old school, very traditional, right? It was shoe leather and the phone directory, you know, and trade shows and pressing the flesh. And, you know, here we are 40 years later, and you've got AI and you've got, you know, automations and tools, you know, a plethora of tools, but BizCrunch amongst them, to help you put your search on autopilot. And I think that changes the landscape a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I have to quit my job in order to search mentality, I think when you quit your job becomes potentially an option. You know, do you do it when you've got a pipeline of on and off market deals that, you know, you're busily cultivating, rather than when you've got a blank canvas at the very beginning? And I don't know, I just feel like the tech is a bit of a catalyst for a change in the trend.
Oh, hugely. I mean, you know, we're seeing a move from the research phase, even before you begin outreach. You know, that's been slashed from, you know, weeks and months to hours. And that's something that, you know, we were really passionate about when we started BizCrunch, was that we spoke to lots of people who were, you know, combing through 5 or 6 different data sources, trying to patch it together. I think if you remember, one of our early design partners was paying his kids to input data into an Excel spreadsheet. He was paying a sort of couple of quid per line while they were home from uni, because it's just a slow and painstaking process. And it would take a couple of months to build a list to then go out and do the outreach for. And then you have to wait for, you know, outreach replies, and that takes some time as well. And I think, you know, being able to slash that time and to get to conversation that much faster is absolutely going to be a huge catalyst for change.
Yeah, and I had that other client that who's paying his kids to lick the stamps and seal the envelopes and you know do, yes. do the printing and sending out the mail merge. So yeah. I think this tech, if there's any negative consequence, it's these kids are out of work.
that was my mission.
Another way to pay the bug money.
Yeah, that was my mission at BizCrunch, to put students out of work. No, and I think that, obviously this is something we've been a big proponent of at BizCrunch, is the sort of advent of AI becoming much more than, a machine for chatbots. I read some interesting stats, and I'll put all of my sources at the bottom of this video for anyone who wants to read a bit more. That a poll of searchers, this was in the US, but we can translate it loosely here, said that from the 18% who currently regularly use AI in their search is looking to rise by 2027 to 80%. Which is significant, shows a significant move in that direction. I would be surprised actually if it's as low as 80% in a couple of years' time. I think the adoption might grow a little bit faster than that.
Yeah, it's going to be table stakes. And I think it's not just in your search or just in your outreach. I think it's in your triaging, your diligencing. We're at the cusp of being able to press a button on your deals in your deal tracker and get an industry report about that particular company, how it sits in the context of the industry that it serves. These kind of these additional resources that are at your fingertips now to be able to really help you make an informed decision about the businesses that you want to run with, I think are going to be super helpful. Probably be an exponent for the number of searches and hopefully for the number of deals that get closed.
Yeah, I think it has to be. I think, at the moment there's a sort of feeling, hey, we're moving in a better direction, but it's sort of wading through treacle. I think, again, a lot of the paperwork stuff and the due diligence, when you talked about a kind of conveyor belt of buyers, buying companies, improving their metrics, getting their revenue up, maybe packaging them up with a couple more roll-ups and selling to PE and then starting that cycle again. And I think that if the time to, complete deals shrinks from 2 years to 2 months, then, that's going to be a huge catalyst for growth in ETA. And I think that's something that I'm very excited about, but I think it's something that our listeners and the sort of wider community should be excited about, because I think it's going to a real sort of strap a rocket to the back of the movement.
The only way it shrinks to months versus years, though, in reality, is with better collaboration and more of a network effect. So, you've got the thing that still baffles me about search is the blank canvas situation of, and what's left behind in the wake after a searcher has done one deal. You start with this top of funnel and there are thousands of potential companies and you get down to effectively one. And along the journey, you've had a fair few conversations, but you just haven't progressed with some companies, but you throw them back, you fished, you've caught and you've thrown them back, and it's for someone else to go in that big blue ocean and find that same fish, which really I find baffling, because that someone has taken that seller on a emotional, intellectual journey towards exiting their business. I think that's made them ready for the next searcher or acquirer to come along and pick up that conversation and move it forward, and there just hasn't till now been the infrastructure for that to happen.
I totally agree. I think for a business owner that hasn't explored the option of exiting, and their succession plans, which lots haven't, I think that move from zero to one, I haven't considered it at all. And now I'm thinking about it, is a bigger mindset shift than going from, one to 10, which is the actual sale of the business. Because I know obviously deals can break down and terms change and things pop up in due diligence and what have you. But I think once you've got them over the line of, I would actually quite like to sell my business, that's a massive part of the battle won. And yeah,
It works. It needles away at you. As a seller, you're like, you're intellectually committed to the idea. You've almost spent the money. Oh, I'll go out and buy my new house, or buy that yacht I've always wanted, or buy that holiday home in Marbella, or whatever. So once you've made that kind of journey, from zero to one journey of I'm off. Oh no, I'm on. Well, it's hard going back. It's hard putting that back in the box, right? I think what we have got macroeconomically is a lot of kind of conspiring factors that are creating an increase in the number of sellers. So we all know about the silver tsunami, and we know we've got the sort of demographic pressure, the generational wealth transfer. I'm not going to go back over that, but that is still a massive driver. But add to that the kind of compounding tax burden and bureaucratic burden on business owners that have had 30, 40 years running their businesses and have never known it so challenging and less rewarding, if you like, on a day-to-day basis than it has been in recent years. You know, you've got a lot of motivated sellers that are like, I want to cash in, particularly because of the tapering off of the business asset disposal relief and business property relief. And like there is a ticking clock for these folks now. So it really is, I think, to an extent, a buyer's market, particularly if you're up in the regions Manchester. I know that's where you live, out the region beyond the wall.
Yeah,
exactly that. But yeah, if you're going outside of the bubble of the Southeast, where multiples are a little bit more toppy because there's more competition, if you get out to the West Mids and the Northwest and the Northeast and beyond, there are some fabulous businesses that, you know, don't want hundreds of times EBITDA. You know, they're just looking for a credible exit, and often with seller finance available and all that kind of stuff. So I think there's still a plethora of company. I mean, we've calculated it's probably 36 years worth of deal flow at current rates of annual acquisition. Something has to happen to mop that up, right?
Well, and perhaps more so because we are seeing more and more businesses either reaching that, you know, the 1 mil threshold, which is generally a sort of lower limit for us on BizCrunch, and also more and more business owners reaching retirement age, and that's only going to accelerate. So actually, I think that the number of businesses coming to the table is growing even faster than the searches. And actually, if we go back to what we spoke about earlier, the one piece of the puzzle that's missing is the funding, because we've got more and more searches coming to the market, more and more sellers coming to the market. If we could figure out that, you know, final piece of the puzzle and get some more money pumped in, we could really start to see a big shift. I wanted to go back to, you briefly touched on the business property relief, and there's a sort of plus and a minus here, because so currently BPR means that inheriting a business is tax-free, but from April 2026, the relief will be capped at only the 100% on the first 1 million business value, right? And above that, it's 50% relief.
Yeah, so it matches to, it's a similar kind of mindset to the business asset disposal.
Now, that's potentially positive for acquirers, because there are going to be more companies coming to the table, you know, nudging more owners to sell before 2026. They want to maximize their retirement proceeds and what have you, and it's less attractive to go a succession plan through your family. But then that's also potentially a negative for inheritance and for succession, because, you know, part of the reason we do this is not just to help searchers acquire businesses, but we do see a kind of wider economic issue of businesses not being passed down, you know, petering out at the end of their life rather than continuing to be strong and employing people and making money and pumping into the economy. So
lack of success,
never solved that one.
The kids not wanting to take it on. Yeah, we've seen it. But I've spoken to a number of sellers, a number of owners in recent months since that announcement of the budget about the potential, about inheritance tax capture on private companies. So like historically, you could hand your business on to your kids and they wouldn't pay IHT on the company. That, not so anymore. So we've heard the furore over farmers, and you know, the same is true in the sort of the SMB land, where these assets were to be generational and now they're under fire, and it's motivated a number of owners to go, well, you know, what's the point? why don't I seek my exit now?
Yeah,
because it might as well just be cash.
Interestingly, and another thing that I've sort of uncovered while you know, researching and looking to some of the sort of future trends for this episode, is there's been a real growth in employee ownership trusts as well across the UK. So there is a 0% capital gains incentive for qualifying sales for ownership trusts. So obviously, you know, goes back to the change in tax landscape. But it looks like the sector's growing 37% year on year. And by mid-2024, 6% of all UK business sales were going to employee trusts. And I had no idea that it was so large. I mean, 6% is still small, and it's obviously not a huge sample size. There aren't a huge amount of sales that happen, but even 6% is larger than I'd expected.
Yeah, so what? EOTs have been around for over a decade now. I think 2014 they came to the market.
Yes, 2014.
How many have we seen in a decade?
We have seen 1,650 in a decade. Right.
So about 160.
Yeah.
Small beer. I mean, no wonder the growth rate is 37% per annum, because you're starting from a very low base. I mean, I think they serve a great purpose. I do think they can be complex to set up. decreasingly, because I think there are some great solutions now for that. But what I haven't heard of is the what next, like these employees that own the EOT and have given that tax-free exit to the founder or the previous owner. What's their option? What's their exit? Because it's quite difficult to buy a business that's owned by an EOT. Often there's some conditionality around this long-term earnout that's being paid to the original seller, because it's being paid off from the profits from the company. Well, sure. Some of that is often either like backloaded. In the event that we get an exit, blah, blah, blah. So the multiple can be quite toppy in an EOT sense. So where you're going to get your arbitrage is questionable.
That's super interesting. And I think, as you said, it's been around for sort of over a decade. So there should be some more stories about, you know, the what next of EOTs. Maybe that's maybe I can try and find someone to come on the podcast and give us their story of what happened. Because I think that would be...
I know a very good solution for EOT setup. So perhaps we can get that team to come and give us the lowdown. I don't want to cast aspersions, but I too haven't heard of a formerly EOT, you know, run business that has exited to private equity or listed or whatever. So I think it adds complexity.
Do you think maybe also there's different motivations? Do you think perhaps the type of business that goes into an EOT it suits the business owner and the type of business and the sort of culture there for it to not sell to private equity and for it to stay within employee hands?
100%.
Yeah. It's an interesting route. I mean, again, perhaps not relevant for our listeners, but it's something that I'd heard about, but I didn't know, you know, even 1,650 of them in the last 10 years is more than I'd expected. I thought it was a more sort of niche thing that you saw around, I don't know. The only EOT I know of was around a range of organic greengrocers. I kind of thought it was, you know, just for businesses like that, you know.
It tends to be those kind of values-led businesses, yeah. Remember, you know, it's a double-edged sword that doesn't necessarily serve the cold-hearted capitalist very well, because, yes, it's tax-free, which is wonderful, but it's paid down over like a decade. So, you know, it's disadvantageous in terms of net present value and, like, you know, it doesn't keep pace with inflation. Sure. Isn't it better to have 70% of your money up front and a 2-year deferred consideration from, you know, an investor acquirer? Probably yes. But, you know, you pay your money, it takes your choice. They're out there. It's another method. And I'm all for succession. So whatever gets these businesses carrying on and continues to contribute to the economy. I guess the last question we should probably end on is what businesses, what are the trends going to be in terms of sectors? You know, we've seen a number of very busy acquisition focused sectors, both in B2C and B2B. And, you know, we hear the same ones being trotted out quite frequently. It's actually quite refreshing when I speak to a searcher and they're like, oh, I'm not going to look in the Southeast. I'm going to look in the Northwest, and I'm not going to look at nurseries. I'm going to look at engineering companies. And I'm like, oh, happy days.
I feel the same. I do, you know, the majority of the VizCrunch demo. So I speak to searchers who are actively looking all the time. And if I speak to somebody who says, you know, I used to be an engineer and I really want to buy engineering firms in the West Midlands, I'm like, great, you're going to have much less competition too. As opposed to the more regular, I'd like to buy a care home in the Southeast. It's always refreshing to see some. But look, those categories are popular for a reason.
Yes, there's a kind of basic impetus there, which is aging population or increasing population. The whole kind of health space you've got a guaranteed future there, haven't you? So I can certainly see why. And historically, they've been fragmented sectors. So, you know, they do speak to a need for consolidation. So I get it. But I think they've got over competed in terms of the number of searchers looking to acquire them and try and achieve some kind of unicorn type outcomes from them, because you end up paying far more going in, and it makes the arbitrage, you know, the upside, more difficult to achieve.
I do wonder also if we start to see, you know, a lot more roll-ups and consolidation in care homes, as we did with vets in the sort of previous decade, if that does bring the CMA knocking, who, again, I know we look generally at the sort of upper end of the market, but have become more interested in consolidated industries because, you know, lower choice and higher prices and what have you. And they took a real keen eye on veterinary services. And I wonder if, are these more popular categories, if that starts to become an issue going forward?
Yeah, if the Competition and Markets Authority is starting to say, hang on a minute, we're losing the free market forces in this space. And yeah, they've been rolled up. It's probably after the fact. I think we're a fair way away from that with some of these health and care businesses. I think there's still a lot of fragmentation. But I do think it's got very toppy. It's the new HVAC, right? Everybody wants them. Similarly, like nurseries at the other end of the spectrum, of the life cycle. Nurseries are, there's an increasing number of people buying early years. Some of them hugely well funded. We spoke about that on a previous pod. I think those in a B2C sense are toppy. Nice to see renewed focus on some accounting roll ups. I've seen more of those. I guess the AI kind of obvious AI play in accountancy. Same with legal. These white collar professional services. That's an interesting avenue that I'm speaking to more people that are actively keen to acquire there. What else?
Energy and renewables is another one that we're starting to see a push in. I mean, obviously, the market and generally and consumers are starting to lean more towards renewables, but also, you know, there are government subsidies and plans and packages and all sorts of things out there to help homeowners and businesses and move in that general direction. I know that we don't have to comply with everything sort of EU-wise, but even going down to sort of trucking, Toby and I talked about a haulage company last month, there's going to be more regulations about sort of EV trucks and what have you. So that seems to be a sort of growing category, and one that I'm coming across more and more often.
It speaks to the maturity of things like PV panels, photovoltaic panels. And air source heat pumps and things like that. Those are areas of kind of like the electrical and plumbing type markets that are still very fragmented. They've reached a maturity. There's a sort of a vintage of those businesses that are now at scale and are acquirable and have maybe ownership of the retirement age or whatever. But it speaks to the fact that this is here to stay, which is good.
Yeah, and anecdotally, I one of my very first jobs that I worked for a renewable energy company, I sold air source, ground source heat pumps, wind turbines, the small ones. This was almost 20 years ago. And at that point, it was a very new thing. I was speaking to lots of property developers who had never heard of this before. We'd have to kind of bring them to site and show them one. This is an air source heat pump. This is how it works. And we've come a long way in that short space of time, I think. You know, you can buy PV tiles in IKEA now, so... it's definitely a much more mature market.
Sorry, you got me giggling about IKEA for some scurry. good. Well, I mean, I think it ultimately, if we can conclude anything, there's plenty more to play with. There's plenty of businesses in the sort of Northern European, Western European sort of markets that need to sell. There still isn't enough. I don't think we're saturated by the number of acquirers that can come along and do this, be they search, be they, you know, trade or investment buyers. We've still got a plethora of businesses that are too small for private equity and therefore need to be scaled before they have a defined exit opportunity. So, it is an exciting time to be searching. It's a joy and a privilege to be speaking to so many intelligent, driven people that have cottoned on that this space is going to be rewarding, more rewarding than the venture, trap, for want of a better phrase.
And it's always a funny conversation when we talk about the difference between sort of venture and ETA, because we are helping people do ETA, but we are also a startup. So we're bridging that gap. I suppose we get to see sort of both sides of the aisle. But yes, it's super exciting. I mean, look, it's one of my favorite things about working in this industry is talking to all the new people, you know, learning about the new deals and the direction that the market's moving in and going to events, you know, again, talk about serial acquirer symposium. I had such a great time talking to everybody there and feeling that sort of buzz in the room. And I get it on, you know, calls I speak to, you know, searches in all different parts of the world. I'm increasingly, you know, spoke about Germany earlier. I speak to people in Germany saying, can you come and do this for us in Germany? And we need a bigger scene here. And we've got our first event in Berlin. And it is a really, really exciting space to be in right now. And I feel very blessed to be part of it.
Well, to that end, look, yeah, let's collab. Let's do whatever we can to help proliferate this movement more aggressively, more actively, expeditiously across Europe. It's still, you know, lagging 30 years behind the US. Come one, come all. I think, you know, there's plenty of opportunity here. And let's work together to make those opportunities a reality.
Absolutely. I think before we go, we've got some, you know, exciting news on that front in a couple of different avenues for BizCrunch. So again, we're always trying to push to make ETA more accessible and to help more acquisition entrepreneurs and, you know, encourage more succession. So as of next week, we will actually be hosting seller verified listings on our platform. So not only the off-market search that we are best known for, but, you know, vetted, ready to contact listings from sellers that we've, you know, spoken to and spent some time with. And I think that's a really exciting move for us and for our users.
Yeah. I mean, look, off-market search is vital. I think that's where the value is, but it takes time to cultivate, both to, you know, make the right fit with the seller's mindset at the point that they actually think, I might be interested in a conversation. But then once you start that conversation, you've got to build a relationship. So, you know, that it isn't, Rome wasn't built in a day. So it can be frustrating if you're in a hurry. So having, this is why a number of searchers, you know, turn to the broker market. And I think that's, you know, there are some really, really great independent brokers. We've lamented before some of the institutional kind of like SDR shops that maybe aren't brokers, but seem to be making a lot of money in the process. So I think there is room for a middle ground where, like, you know, the folks that have come through the off-market piece and are now interested in being connected to other potential acquirers get a bit of exposure, because those deals will get done more rapidly. So delighted that we're now in a position at BizCrunch to be putting some of those, joining some of those dots and putting some of those parties together, and more to come.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's not it from us. We've got another big announcement, which is towards the end of this month. We'll also be launching the BizCrunch Virtual Data Room. Again, just a step towards becoming that operating system for SMB M&A, trying to make that due diligence process just easier, smoother, and also the whole sort of searching and sourcing process to make it more sort of holistic, keeping it in one place, less for you to think about when it comes to perhaps even the less exciting part of acquiring a business, which is, you know, finding data, doing outreach, tracking them, due diligence stuff, you know, and frees you up more time to do the fun bits, talk to people, go to site, build your growth plans, go out and fundraise.
And given that we've made this an epic episode and we're now nudging up against the hour, I guess I'll get on my soapbox for a second and talk a little bit about what motivated us to build a VDR rather than go and work with others that are out there already. It's very established. You know, there's plenty of VDR players in the market, many of them that are partying like it's 1995. Some even built each other. We wanted something that was fit for the AI age, so that you could, you know, very quickly RAG and AI analyze or use it, put an LLM across your data and get some insights. Now, the infrastructure required for that is a different shape to the traditional kind of data rooms. I mean, that is driven API first, and that is, you know, built on modern infra. So that's what we set out to build, and, you know, we're able to bring this to market now in an AI ready format. So watch this space. Certainly it's a very affordable and scalable solution for lawyers and brokers and accountancies and various folks that might want to spin up data rooms for their clients. Very agile and very integratable with your products too. So listeners, if you're out there in the digital scene and are looking to spin up data rooms programmatically, BizCrunch has you covered.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic note to end on. This has been a mammoth episode, but there's just been so much exciting stuff to cover. But I think that's all from me, Gareth. Is there anything else from you this week?
Nope. Keep on crunching. Until then, folks, thanks a lot.
Keep on crunching.